From WBUR Boston, this is Here and Now, a daily digest of news and culture.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Dogpile.com. All of these search engines piled into one: Google, Yahoo, LiveSearch, and Ask.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we start in Pakistan, where it appears next week's elections will be put off after the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. Pakistan's Election Commission said today it has recommended an unspecified delay, and a final decision will be announced tomorrow. That delay would come despite demands by Bhutto's party, the Pakistan People's Party, and other opposition politicians that elections be held as scheduled, January 8th. Jonathan Landay is a reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. He joins us from Karachi. And Jonathan, Benazir Bhutto reportedly named her husband to succeed her in her will. He will preside over the day-to-day affairs of her party, but named their teenage son to take over when he graduates from Oxford. What's been the reaction?
The announcement really didn't come as much of a surprise to people because most people understand that in order to remain viable, the party, which is a dynastic institution that was begun by Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, Benazir's father, has to have a Bhutto in the top slot. Therefore, her 90-year-old son was made the chairman, but her husband was made the co-chairman and will indeed run the day-to-day affairs of the party, albeit with a Bhutto, his son, at the top.
Right. But who will be the candidate? Because, as we said, the party wants the elections to go ahead on January 8th, so who will run?
There is a vice chairman of the party who has been running the party during Benazir's 8 years in political exile. He has been mentioned as a possible candidate, but it's not really apparent at this point.
And we should say the other main opposition party, their candidate was Nawaz Sharif, had been boycotting the elections. Now, with Bhutto's party saying they want the elections, Sharif's party has also said they want the elections to go ahead. What has the government said about delaying the elections?
The government of President Pervez Musharraf has not said anything about the delay in the elections. There have been senior figures in the ruling party that have talked about the likelihood of a delay. But what has happened with the decisions by the People's Party and the faction of the Muslim League headed by Nawaz Sharif is, in fact, the possibility of a confrontation because if indeed a very long delay is announced, and these parties have said they want to go ahead with the election, there could be trouble over that. And indeed, I've talked to People's Party leaders here in Karachi, which is a People's Party stronghold, and they have said that they would begin an agitation if the government announced a long delay in the election.
Well, that's the elections. We continue to see conflicting reports on just how Benazir Bhutto died, the government insisting that it was the force of the suicide bomb that caused her to hit her head. But there is new video of what appears to be a man shooting at her with a gun, an outstretched arm with a gun. How are Pakistanis reacting to that?
This new video was aired by Channel 4 in Britain, and it's the second bunch of pictures that have raised serious questions and doubts about the government's version of what happened, because it does indeed show a gunman apparently firing at her, and her hair and her scarf kind of going up with what appeared to be the force from the striking of the bullet. There was also video that was produced yesterday that appears to have shown the very same thing. So all of this has really stoked suspicions and accusations throughout Pakistan of possible government complicity in her death.
And Jonathan, what about daily life there in Pakistan? We've seen the pictures of the rioting, the protests, banks burned, trucks burned. How much of an impact has this had on the ability of Pakistan to function?
The country ground to a total halt over the 3 days of a strike that was called to protest Benazir's death and commemorate her life. And it was a really curious thing that happened here in Karachi this morning. The city started crawling back to normal. People were out on the street. Traffic was back in the street. Banks were open. And then rumors spread by cell phone and word of mouth started coursing through the city, and literally within minutes, everything started shutting down again. And these rumors were that there had been gunfire in various parts of the city and that a prominent local politician had been murdered. I was in one of the main markets when these rumors started coursing through the main market. And as I said, within minutes, shutters were being drawn down on the fronts of shops. Public transportation was being withdrawn from the streets. The city was once again shut down.
It just goes to show how prickly the situation is. Jonathan Landay, reporter from McClatchy newspaper, speaking to us from Karachi in Pakistan. Jonathan, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, today we want to reprise our conversation about memory loss, in part to remind ourselves that, according to researchers, today's workers, especially baby boomers, are putting in longer hours than their parents did with more information thrown at them. And they may also be having a delayed reaction to decades-old bumps on the head from accidents or football tackles. Catherine Jacobson-Raymond was a hard-hitting journalist whose memory began slipping when she hit her 40s. She discovered others encountering the same thing, not just forgetting keys, but calling high-level meetings and then forgetting why. Her own memory loss, as she tried to raise two little boys with her husband and continue with her work, was so anxiety-provoking that she turned herself into a human guinea pig, embarking on a 3-year journey that took her to sleep clinics, neuropsychologists, dementia, head injury, thyroid, and menopause experts, nutritionists, even salsa dancing experts. Catherine Jacobson-Raymond tells her resulting book. It's called Carved in Sand: When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. She told us that she found a lot of shame and secrecy about memory loss as baby boomers tried to hold on to their jobs.
I was been a journalist for many, many years, and I've interviewed people on basically every subject, including infidelity, and I've never seen so many people need to be anonymous as I saw when we were talking about memory.
You wrote up a 10-page questionnaire, a survey that you sent out, and it started to exponentially spread around the world, you know, people sending it to other people. What were some of the things, quickly, that people said about memory loss?
People had lots of things to say. Often they talked about how tricky it was to be middle-aged in a work environment where people were generally much younger. Mm-hmm. There's a physiological basis for what's happening here. It's not something that you're imagining. As you enter your late 20s, your processing speed begins to slow down. And you typically do not notice this in your 30s because you have sufficient cognitive reserve, enough spare neurons, as it were, to get you through. Now, as you enter your 40s, that number of neurons begins to dwindle just a little bit, and a lot of times people really start to feel it.
As you point out, in your 50s and 40s, you're also grappling with little kids, which previously those kids would have been grown up. You'd have a lot less to remember.
Well, I always say that menopause and adolescence should never meet, but they do the time now.
So. You compare this to 1876 when Graham Bell invented the phone, and there were suddenly all sorts of new illnesses, railway neurosis, elevator sickness. People were rattled by that. As you write, they are rattled now by this onslaught of technology information. So to get to the bottom of your memory problems, you undertook 10 interventions. It was just amazing to go with you. As we said, you made yourself this sort of guinea pig, went for a full evaluation for Alzheimer's, went for full nutritional workups, went to sleep clinics, underwent neurofeedback to manipulate your brain waves. You had little shocks in your head, took part in mindful meditation, got a full neuropsychological evaluation, went on the drugs Adderall and Provigil.
Correct.
Yep. You got a diagnosis. But along the way, what did you find out?
Well, I found out that memory is actually not what we're dealing with in middle age. We are dealing with issues of attention, distraction, concentration, and focus. Now, we like to lump all of these under this general term, memory loss. It's actually inaccurate. When we're talking about memory loss, what we're talking about, if someone hands you a multiple choice vocabulary test, and on it are words you've known all your life, and now you don't know some of them, that would be memory loss, that would be very serious, that would be pathological. Mm. That is not what we are dealing with in middle age, typically. In middle age, what we're dealing with is what one scientist called a neural bouncer who has gone on a coffee break. Now, get the image, the neural bouncer, just like the bouncer out in front of a nightclub with a velvet rope. When you're younger, that bouncer is in position and things are not going in that should not be going in. As you get older, the neural bouncer goes off on these coffee breaks and suddenly all sorts of riffraff makes it past the rope. So there's constant background noise infiltrates.
Is this what you found was called attention deficit trait, not ADHD? But attention deficit trait, ADT.
Well, attention deficit trait is not my term. It's actually Edward Hallowell's term, and he is a psychiatrist over in Sudbury.
Here in Massachusetts,
who is a specialist in ADHD and certainly one of the foremost in the world. And I went to talk to him after I read a piece that he'd written for the Harvard Business Review, where he described this phenomenon of having suddenly flood tides of adults, many of them middle-aged, coming to his office saying, "Doctor, I think I've developed ADD. And he thought...
Attention deficit disorder.
Exactly. Yeah. He thought to himself, well, how could this be possible? I mean, these people were fine as children. So he started to look at this very closely. And what he realized was that this was purely environmental. If you pluck these people out of a situation where they were being bombarded and pounded to death with information and interruption and plop them down by a nice calm lake someplace, all these problems went away. It wasn't in them. It was from outside them.
Yeah. Oh, well, let's tick through some of the other things you discovered. You had the UCLA Memory Clinic brain scan. What did you learn there?
Well, I had a PET scan and I had an MRI. I had a full blood workup. I had a brief neuropsychological exam and a bunch of other things as well.
But you found out you were starving your brain and you
exactly.
needed to eat more protein in the morning.
I needed to get more glucose delivered on a more regular basis to my brain. The brain runs on glucose. Glucose is the brain's only fuel. And if you do not get it to the brain will quit working. And you will find yourself in the slows and lows and feel really, really dumb, and you won't know why.
Again, moving through what you learned, the nature-nurture argument. There's a study that showed that rats who were better coddled and cared for by their mothers had less memory problems?
Yes, in middle age. Isn't that something?
Something, yeah.
It really is. Well, this particular study, which was done by Tally Barham, showed that when mother rats were deprived of sufficient bedding for their young, they found that stressful. And although the infants were generally resembled all other rat infants, by the time they got to middle age, they had memory problems. They had cognitive issues, and they were not able to find their way through mazes nearly as well. So if you're having trouble getting through the airport, that could be part of the reason.
It's amazing stuff. And some of the things you rejected, you said this isn't for me, you know, for your issue. But some you realized could be. For instance, you learned that concussions as a kid can affect us in middle age? Concussions we didn't even really think about.
That's right. Well, no one does. You know, you take a fall off a bike as a kid, and if you socked your chin, your brain went rocketing back into your head and behaved like a super ball. And it's very, very possible that you had a mild concussion. You certainly don't need to be unconscious to have had one. One concussion is not great, but successive concussions in short order, weeks or months apart, can be very, very damaging, whether they occur in childhood or in adulthood. And as athletes, this can be a problem.
That's Catherine Jacobson-Raymond on Memory Loss. Later, why you need a calculator for the Iowa caucuses. But we'll be back in a minute with more from Catherine here and now. We're hearing about memory loss from Catherine Jacobson-Raymond, author of Carved in Sand, When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. When she hit her 40s, she made herself a test subject and underwent a battery of tests. She tried meditation, prescription drugs, all in an effort to boost her failing memory. And she discovered that perhaps a long-ago fall from a horse might be a factor. One doctor, in assessing her childhood head injuries, said that Catherine was like two people, one impressively competent, the other incredibly deficient.
Kind of insulting.
Well,
it's a little hard to take.
Yeah.
But he said it, and I had to deal with it.
Well, and that it's almost like that's the worst place to be in.
Because he said it was the best place because he said if I was only the person who was deficient, it would be all over for me. He said that the fact that in some tests I was impressively competent meant that I could find a way to make up for the parts that weren't working. Right. And that's what I spent 3 years figuring out.
Right. Well, continuing along the trail with you, when I came to the chapter on drugs, I thought, well, now this is interesting, especially some drugs that are used for memory enhancement in Europe that aren't legal here. But as you started to take them and you started to feel better, there were points where you felt better. I thought, what's next? And what was next that you decided that maybe there was a trade-off you weren't willing to have of your physical health?
Well, you know, I was given a prescription for Adderall, which is actually a drug that is commonly used to treat the results of mild traumatic head injury and is often very successful in treating it. And I found while taking Adderall that there were great improvements. My word recall changed dramatically. I was much better able to navigate in places that I had been before. Things were just better in terms of work, but they were much, much worse in terms of the rest of my life. I simply did not have the personality that I started with.
Right.
And I found that I was just turned into a workaholic and I didn't have a life. Yeah. And during this period, I realized that there was another drug, and it was called Provigil, and it was being studied both in the UK and very, very heavily, I might add, by the US military. And Provigil was a drug that was originally designed to help narcoleptics, people who fall asleep suddenly. And eventually that labeling was extended to daytime sleepiness and other factors. But what it really, really does is enhance attention. And I had done a lot of research on it. I presented that to a neurologist that I was seeing. And he eventually, long after I was off of Adderall completely, gave me a prescription for it. And I found that it was very, very helpful.
Well, I want to touch on two things before we get to your final diagnoses. Because, of course, you can't do this without talking about Alzheimer's and menopause. And you find all sorts of interesting things about Alzheimer's, including that it actually begins earlier than we think. There's seeds of it that are sown earlier and visible earlier in midlife, and people need to push doctors to ask about that.
Yeah, it's a really scary thing to have to do, but new research shows that this disease is not a disease of old age. This is a disease where the seeds are planted in midlife. And now scientists
can you offset it? Can you offset it?
You sure can. You certainly can. Now, you know, not everyone is going to be able to, but there are how you live your life, how you take care of your body, how you take care of your mind, whether you feed yourself properly, whether you get the right amount of aerobic exercise, which is turning out to be very, very important. Depression is not a good thing. And depression leads to Alzheimer's in very high numbers. But also the idea of maintaining a mental challenge. Now, this is harder than you'd think, actually. We say, oh, we go to work, we go home, we, you know, we do the second shift, we're so busy, we have our philanthropy, we have our community work. It's just, you know, who has time? But the fact is that in order to build new neural pathways and keep synaptic connections really lively, what you need to do is have that mental challenge, which means doing something different than what you do all the time.
To menopause, it was interesting to read that a lot of people attribute the memory loss to the disappearance of estrogen, but as you write, the lack of estrogen only affects, was it verbal memory?
Well, this is very controversial, first of all. And the studies show that, several studies show that the faculty primarily affected is verbal. So you will find that there's more word loss, etc. Now, people tend to attribute absolutely everything to the loss of estrogen. And one thing is that women often tell me that they know the reason for all of these cognitive problems is menopause. They're wrong. It actually happens that menopause occurs, you know, around 50, you know, in your early 50s, which is a time that men and women experience these cognitive changes.
Well, eventually, you were diagnosed with hypothyroidism. It took 8 years to get to this correct diagnosis. Can you just briefly tell us, what was it, and how did it affect your memory?
Well, early in my 40s, I noticed that several things were happening, and this was concurrent with my memory, with the changes in my memory. I had moved from Southern California to Northern California and started a new job and moved into a new house on the same day I started the new job. And I had two little kids, and I had lost a lot of weight, and my hair was falling out, and things were not looking good. And I went to an endocrinologist, and I said, hey, look at me. And she said, well, you know, it looks like a thyroid disorder. And then she ordered the tests, and after the test, she said, well, tests don't say that. You don't have a thyroid disorder. I guess you're fine, and you can go away now. Try to eat. Now, it's a little complicated, but there's a great debate raging about where appropriate thyroid levels should be set, and that if we looked closely and accurately, tons and tons and tons of people have subclinical thyroid disorders, which may result from there being so little iodine in our water supply now. That has been more or less removed.
And just again, if people have just tuned in and thought, oh, what the heck, so every now and then you lose your keys. It's not that.
It's very painful. It destroys self-confidence. It hurts self-esteem. It's hard to recover. And I know that I heard from hundreds and hundreds of midlife people that it is really something that bothers them. And, you know, given the interest in the book, I have to think that they were right. It is a generally a serious question for people.
Tomorrow. Tomorrow on Here and Now, are college students apathetic? A group of Harvard alumni says yes, and they want Harvard to do something about it. Still ahead today, the invasion of the ladybugs, Here and Now. A bunch of party animals show up and stand in a corner. That's one way of defining this Thursday's Democratic caucuses in Iowa. The Republicans simply cast a non-binding straw vote, but the Democrats literally go and stand in their candidate's corner in their local caucus rooms. And if that candidate doesn't get enough corner standers, well, that's when the real fun begins, the mind-blowing math. Do not try this at home. With us on the line to try to explain is Marcia Fulton. She's a native Iowan and retired Florida school administrator who is now the vice chair of Union County Democrats in Iowa. She'll be running a caucus precinct for the first time on Thursday. Marcia, how are you feeling about that?
Excited, apprehensive, and like I need to do studying.
Yeah, it's very complicated. So let's remind people, first of all, on Thursday, caucus goers aren't really going to be, you know, selecting a presidential candidate. What officially are they doing?
Well, officially, they are selecting their preference, which will then go up to the convention. And then the person that has the most delegates at the convention then would win Iowa.
Right. Every county has a different number of delegates. Well, walk us through this. We understand Iowa residents will show up at the caucus sites. By the way, what kind of places are the sites?
We're going to be at the middle school, so it has a large open area. And then everyone has to register when they come in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they're already a registered Democrat, they will sign next to their name, much as when you go to vote that you do.
Well, this is important because we understand during the Iowa caucuses, you can come as an independent and register.
You can. Or if you were a Republican and were particularly more interested in voting on the Democratic side, you could register that night and become a Democrat and caucus for your candidate.
Okay, now caucusing, you've just used it as a verb. So when people are caucusing, they're in this large room. Then is there a moment where someone says, okay, go, and they go into the corner with the candidate's name on it?
There is. Anyone who is in line by 7 o'clock will be allowed to caucus, and you start the caucus as close to 7 as you can.
Okay, so now these clusters of supporters, let's say Hillary Clinton's name is in one corner, there's a cluster there, and Barack Obama's in another corner, cluster there, John Edwards another corner, on and on. And they're all the clusters of the supporters. Now, this is when it starts to become a combination of musical chairs and square dancing. Because what happens from here? You have sort of a math equation that you have to use to see if a candidate is viable. Talk us through that.
Right. If you were going to elect 3 delegates, the viable group would have to contain 1/6 of the attendees. For 4 or more, which we are going to elect in ours, the viable group must contain 15% of the attendees. They will count the number of the eligible caucus attendees and announce that number. Then viability is based on the number of delegates that the precinct gets. And as remember, I said here in Union County, we're going to elect four more delegates, where in, say, the little town of Lorimer, they're going to elect one, okay? Then you're going to go and stand for your candidate. Say there are 60 eligible attendees at this precinct caucus, and they're going to be electing, say, five delegates to the county convention. And so as not to use current names, we'll use Jefferson, Roosevelt, Kennedy, and Truman.
Okay.
Say 22 members aligned in that preference group for Jefferson. And 16 members went to another corner of the room and under Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
And then 12 members aligned themselves under the sign that said Kennedy, and 10 members went for Truman.
Okay.
So your formula would break down like this for Jefferson. The number of members in that preference group was 22.
Right.
They're going to elect five delegates. So you take 22 times five,
mm-hmm.
and you divide by the 60 people in that room.
Okay. Oy. All right.
I have a cheat sheet here. It's going to come out 1.833 delegates.
Ah, and we're going to round up.
And you're going to round up. So Jefferson's going to get two delegates at that precinct caucus.
Okay. Well, in our hypothetical situation that you laid out, which went from Jefferson through Roosevelt, Kennedy, down to Truman, these hypothetical candidates, if Truman, in our hypothetical situation, had two people, or,
yeah.
you know, and so when you did the math...
They would then have not been able to get a delegate.
So they're not viable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens there?
That's when the really exciting fun of a caucus gets in, because those people probably will go align themselves with their second choice.
Right. This is where it becomes Red Rover, send Truman's
yeah.
delegates over to another
yeah.
corner. They pick another corner to stand in and increase the chances of the corner they pick of getting more delegates.
Right. There actually is a second calculation that is done, and then that is it.
Yeah.
Now, say there's an exact number tie.
Yes.
And you don't have another delegate to award, then you literally can flip a coin.
Oh, there's a lot of drama involved in this.
A lot of drama in it. But there is, it's a lot of fun type of bartering. I think bartering is the word I want.
Huh. Well, it's so fascinating, but why is it done that way? Why don't people just do a hand count? You know, why is it done in this physical sort of square dance way?
My understanding is that this is the way that it has always been done. One of the things about the caucus that is that nothing secret. Everyone will see who you're voting for. With the Democrats, you are literally going out on a blistery, snowy night, probably, at 7 o'clock at night, during the Orange Bowl Classic, during the Orange Bowl game, and you are going to stand for your candidate. And especially, I'm going to say this year, because the candidates are so good, and but you're having to take that, you're having to take that pick, and you're having to let everyone know exactly who you took.
I'm wondering, you mentioned that, Marcia Fulton, it's such a huge field. Do you anticipate that this year there might be a lot of people just standing in the middle of the room trying to decide what corner to go to?
I have heard people and have had that feeling myself, and I'm sitting here going, gee, it would be a wonderful time to have the first woman president. And then it's, you know, can you imagine what a wonderful country would be to elect our first black president? You
yeah.
know, all of these things are going through your mind. And you're listening to them, and you go see them, and you see them frequently. When I lived in Florida, and I would get tickets to go see when Kerry would come to speak, I still was so far away from him that you almost needed binoculars. Here, you do not have that. These folks come, and you really get to shake their hands. They'll take questions. So Iowa gets to know its candidates very well.
And that weighs on your mind, I'm sure, when you're picking your corner on
does.
Thursday.
If you take it extremely seriously, and I don't mean to say other people don't take their candidate choice seriously, because I'm sure they do, but I've never quite felt the weight the way I have in Iowa.
Marcia Fulton is vice chair of Union County Democrats in Iowa. This Thursday, she'll be volunteering at her first caucus, helping to run it. Marcia, bring your calculator.
Absolutely, Robin, I will, and I'm looking forward to it, and I appreciate the call.
And we'll continue to cover the run-up to the Iowa caucuses, but we probably won't do an explainer again. My head hurts. Also this week, Tom Brokaw on the year 1968. You're listening to Here and Now. Do you have a few house guests left over after the holidays, gathering in clusters, exuding pheromones to attract fellow travelers? What? Well, I'm referring, of course, to ladybugs, specifically Asian ladybird beetles. They're native to China and Japan and were introduced in the U.S. to control aphids and other insects decades ago. These are not the typical red ladybugs with black spots that we see in our gardens. These are bigger, and they come in all different colors, and now they're coming in from the cold. David Simser is an entomologist on Cape Cod here in Massachusetts. David, I understand you get a lot of calls, but so do entomologists across the country. This is happening everywhere.
Depending on where you are and the type of house that you're living in, you can have 10,000 of these things in your house. You can have them falling into your coffee, falling into your hair, going down your back, crawling on your TV set, getting into your fish tank. It's more than the one or two creepy crawlers that are moving around.
Are they clustering like a beehive? Or
when they're swarming, and of course they don't sting, but when they're swarming and they're moving around, they can just be everywhere in the air. And if you're outside at the time, and usually it's right around Halloween, they're also called the Halloween ladybird beetle.
Well, and they exude these pheromones, chemicals. What are they for?
Well, possibly. It seems like they first orient to a visual stimulus. They're looking for a rock outcropping, or they're looking for the face of a cliff where they normally overwinter in their native Asia. So if they see a house up on a hillside that's brightly illuminated by the setting sun, they make, well, let's not say a beeline, but they make a beetle line for that house. Once they get inside, there may be something, some chemical and some chemistry that goes on there that says, hey, I found a great place, come on over here and let's settle down. But that hasn't been determined as yet, but it's likely. And they might also market for future generations. If we found a great place, let's leave it for down the line.
What should people do about them? Because you don't want to kill ladybugs.
No, you don't. And, you know, this is one of the classic risk benefit sort of things. They're a very good beneficial species that were introduced into this country, and they're a very good predator of not only aphids, but a lot of other things like scale insects, mites, adelgids, psyllids. So they're good guys. But when they get into your house, then they're not so good. They get in under doors and the attic vents or the soffit vents, and so you really need to put a little bit of a screen over those things as well.
But what about those traps that, you know, that you can set that can collect them indoors and you can release them? Do you recommend those?
Well, no. If you use a handheld vacuum cleaner, that's going to be the way to go. But there's a couple problems with that. One is that, what do you do with them? If you collect them, let's say, today when it's really cold out, if you're releasing them outside, they're just going to freeze. And two, they have this amazing sort of defensive reaction where they bleed through their legs. And they exude a very stinky chemical that can stain furniture and just get on your hands and get on your clothes and really kind of make your house smell funny. So you want to be careful with collecting them, with cleaning them up. If you can just forget about them over the winter, and then when things warm up, open some windows, that's the best thing to do. But I know that not everyone can do that. They don't do anything to the house itself. They have to find a nice, dark, sheltered location, and they'll aggregate in that location, so people should know that they're not in any way structural pests.
They're not like a termite.
Yeah, and you don't have to. One thing you should never do is spray anything inside your house. Some people will resort to a bug bomb. You know, they'll set off something like you would for fleas. First of all, it's not going to work, and secondly, now your house is contaminated with a toxin, so you don't want to do that.
Dave, as long as we have you, the question we really want to get answered, can you tell how old they are by the spots on their back?
No.
Oh.
And actually, this particular species of ladybird beetle, also known as the multicolored Asian ladybird beetle, the Japanese lady beetle, the Halloween beetle, the Harlequin beetle, the pumpkin beetle, the multivariate beetle, the southern beetle, has many different colorations. They can have 19 spots. They can have 0 spots. They can have red spots. They can have black spots. So you really can't tell anything about them from their spots.
That's entomologist David Simser with the Barnstable County Cooperative Extension on Cape Cod. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, ladybugs 12, and ladybugs picnic. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, then 12. They all played games at the Ladybug's picnic. They had 12 sacks, so they ransacked waste. They fell on the backs, they fell on the faces. Ladybug's 12 at Ladybug's picnic. They had to broke, but the rope broke. So just sat around telling knock-knock jokes. Ladybug's 12 at Ladybug's picnic.
The Berklee College of Music here in Boston awarded its first honorary doctorate in 1971 to jazz great Duke Ellington. Later recipients included Paul Simon, Aretha Franklin, Quincy Jones, and this past year, actor, filmmaker, the musician behind the cult classic Spinal Tap, Christopher Guest.
I initially thought it was a typo, which I still think it is.
Well, Berklee didn't think it was a mistake. They invited Guest to spend a day rehearsing students for a sold-out concert. Here and Now's Andrea Shea went to learn more.
This is Spinal Tap is something of a holy grail for musicians, which could make Christopher Guest, who co-wrote the film lyrics and songs, a rock god. In it, he also plays Nigel Tufnell, the flaky, oft-quoted lead guitarist.
This is a top to a... you know, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see, the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, 11,
and most of
11,
these
and then
amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10, one louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Berklee President Roger Brown says the goofy rockumentary captures real life as a working band on the road. And that's why he says Guest's satirical treatments of heavy metal and tap, folk music in A Mighty Wind, and small-town musical theater in Waiting for Guffman earned him his place at Berklee.
I think his contributions have been more to entertain, annoy, poke fun at the world of musicians and to help those people who try to make a profession out of this have a sense of humor about it, see the dark and grotesque side, but also to see it in a playful, loving way.
Weekly Dig critic Dave Wildman is a fan of the cult film, too. But still, he says while Guest's music is clever and solid, Berklee's choice has him scratching his head.
They've either got a really good sense of humor or they've really lowered the bar. Maybe the next step is Snoop Dogg.
Actually, Berklee President Roger Brown says the next step could be a video game soundtrack composer and adds there's always pushback. Christopher Guest finds it ironic, although his musical life started at the High School of Music and Art in New York City, where he studied clarinet. At 14, he picked up the guitar and mandolin. Soon, he was performing live with all kinds of bands, and he hasn't stopped.
I play almost every day. I play things that I write. I play just things as exercises. Could be anything that strikes me at the moment.
That's not the way Skeletons of Quinto sounds in A Mighty Wind, because faculty and students are covering and rearranging Guest's music in jazz, R&B, and even bossa nova styles.
One, two, a one, two, from a lighthouse.
At this rehearsal, Guest plays along.
Golden Gate. From a trawler down in Shreveport to the shores of one great lake.
Sounds more like a munchkin than
it's a helium thing.
Yeah.
Which is not a bad idea. For me, that's way more entertaining than me actually doing it.
But I'm still going to do it. We still like you to do it.
Okay, I'll do it too.
That's from A Mighty Wind, but Spinal Tap appears to be the hands-down favorite among students and faculty.
Well, someone already sent me a stethoscope, so I guess I'll be seeing patients. You know, I'm not trained as a medical doctor, but I can act like a doctor because I'm an actor. My great-grandfather was a doctor. My grandfather was a doctor. All my uncles were doctors.
And now Christopher Guest is an honorary doctor of music.
Here and Now's Andrea Shea. And that night, hundreds of Berklee students crowded an auditorium, dozens more lined the aisles and crammed the stage to join Dr. Guest in a rousing medley of tunes. To see some of the performance, go to our website, here-now.org. And this closing note, jazz pianist Oscar Peterson also received an honorary doctorate from Berklee back in 1984. This is his recording of Perdido. Peterson died on December 23rd at 82. Among the many people he played with over his prolific career, Louis Armstrong, Count Basie, Charlie Parker, Nat King Cole, and Ella Fitzgerald, and Duke Ellington, who said Peterson was the Maharaja of the keyboard. He played, according to Duke Ellington, the very best ivory box I've ever heard. Oscar Peterson was but one of several artists we lost at the end of 2007. Michael Kidd, the choreographer who thrilled film audiences with his work on The Bandwagon and Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, died the same day as Peterson. Troubled R&B singer Ike Turner passed away on December 12th, his reputation as a wife abuser tarnishing the career that included classics like Proud Mary, which he recorded with his former wife Tina Turner.
You know, every now and then, I think you might like to hear something from us. Nice and easy. But there's just one thing, you see. We never, ever do nothing nice and easy. We always do it nice and rough. But we're going to take the beginning of this song and do it easy. But then we're going to do the finish rough. It's the way we do Proud Mary. Rolling, rolling, rolling on the river. Listen to the story now. Left a good job in the city, working for the man every night and day. And I never lost one minute of sleep, and I was worrying about the way that things might have been. Big wind.
Singer Dan Fogelberg lost his 3-year battle with cancer on December 16th. He was 56. Dan had a number of hits through the 70s and 80s, leader of the band, Longer, Part of the Plan, and this bittersweet song, Same Old Lang Syne. The music of Dan Fogelberg, one of many voices silenced at the end of 2007. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. From all of us, have a lovely New Year's Eve and join us in the new year, Here and Now.
Just for a moment, I was back at school and felt that old familiar pain. And as I turned to make my way back, thank you.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.